everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable, episode number 135. Today, we will be covering The Legend of Korra, season 4, episode 10, Operation Beifong, and episode 11, Kuvira's Gambit. We are almost done. Holy crap. If you would like to get in contact with us, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave a comment on this post on hypeable.com. And you can play with us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. Quick roundtable of fun facts. Fun facts are I'm not done watching Jessica Jones yet, and I love you guys desperately, but I'd really rather be doing that right now. Karen, how about you?
I guess I should just make this my fun fact. Fun fact, our next rewatchable is going to be Buffy.
Woo!
Silence. You guys are supposed to be much more excited about that.
I should have just had a mic and dropped it, and then we just end this podcast now.
That's it. Yeah. So, more details.
You're on Beyonce.
I did, kind of, except you guys all knew, so I don't know.
But I don't know who's going to be on it, so there's still some mystery.
That's true. Yeah, more details to come. We'll let you all guys know, but we're def doing Buffy.
It's going to be what, like a year and...
A year and a half.
Okay. It's not even going to be rewatchable. It's just going to be the Buffy podcast.
I mean, basically. This is essentially what Atla and Korra turned into.
Yeah, I mean, we've done some long stuff before, but this might be the biggest straight through undertaking that we've ever done.
Because the Veronica Mars show, if we're just counting that as just one show as opposed to Atla and Korra combined, I think that was our longest show so far, right?
And that was 3 seasons and Buffy is 7.
Yeah, Buffy's like twice as long as everything else that we've done, but it's Buffy, so it's worth it.
Yes, it is.
Very true. Mitch, what's your fun fact?
Well, I think I got my mind blown by the fact that we're talking about Buffy, and I'm like so out of Atla. But I suppose my fun fact is that I'm currently rewatching Gilmore Girls, and my boyfriend was convinced he was never going to like it until he sat down and learned of Lorelai's fabulous, like, coffee sped up speaking, and he just fell in love with her too. And I was like, see, and Paris is in the show, and she's just such an erotic little crazy, and I just love everything about it. So I'm just marathoning that, like, in all my free time that I'm not watching Atla and Korra, which is pretty much never, because I'm always watching those shows too.
Cool, cool. And last but not least, Brittany.
Yeah.
Oh, tired one.
Oh, tired one. I found a new podcast that I'm obsessed with. And
how dare you?
I know. But it's kind of the same concept as Rewatchable. But they're doing a sitcom. So it's called Talk Salad and Scrambled Eggs. And it's Kevin Smith and Matt Mira. And they're rewatching every single episode of Frasier. And it's going to take them 3.5 years. And I am obsessed with it. It is so good because, like, they put the episode on while they're doing it, and it's, oh my gosh, it is so good. Like, they barely even talk about the actual episode. They really are just fangirling over Frasier for, like, an hour, hour 15 every episode. It's so good. Oh my God. I'm starting to see why you can't do, like, what we do here with a sitcom, because it's impossible. Like, they're just like, oh, look at this, like, pratfall, like, you know, stuff like that. Whereas, like, I think we get to a deeper core. But I love listening to people fangirl about Frasier, so that's what.
So they actually, like, commentary it?
Yeah, it's awesome. It's really cool.
Interesting. That's kind of fun just to kind of, like, chill out every day and, you know, plug in the newest episode. I love ways to revisit old shows, like Rewatchable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I just got why it's called Talk Salad and Scrambled Eggs. Okay, that's funny. Frasier is an awesome show.
Yeah,
people haven't watched it. Like, if you're young and haven't watched it, it's amazing, and it's probably one of the smartest sitcoms that's ever been written. At least until, like, the last 3 seasons. But it didn't get bad until, like, the last 3 seasons, which is pretty good because it was a 10-season show.
Yeah, it still wasn't even that bad.
Yeah,
like, it's still watchable.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Anyway. Back to Legend of Korra, chapter 10, we have, did I say my name? Hi, I'm Michal, whatever. Operation Beifong. No, I'm actually Natalie. Operation Beifong. In this episode, Toph comes back to tell us that Sokka is not Lin's dad, and also to bust the Beifong, spelled B-A-F-O-N, B-A-E. Like, instead of B-E-I, like Bay. Okay, anyway, out of prison. Meanwhile, Kuvira is still Hitler, okay, and Prince Wu has a good idea. Yeah, basically the rescue of the Beifong family is the main point of this episode, and Toph finally kind of like goes into somewhat mother mode to agree to help rescue her children and grandchildren and son-in-law. Yeah, I like this episode more for its like little moments, I think, you know, than a lot of big moments in it. Because you know that they're not going to win and they're not going to beat Kuvira because it's episode 10, right? But Brittany, how did you feel?
Well, I've been waiting for Bolin to meet Toph for a while now, so I was pretty thrilled about that. And there was some like kick-ass earthbending in this episode, which I thought was really awesome. So yeah, I thought it felt kind of like fillery. It was one of those things like, well, this has to get done in order for us to move on. So I was fine. It was nice and relaxing to sit through. It wasn't like too intense or anything, but we did it. We got through it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the other side of things, well, this kind of all gets set up because in Republic City, everybody's like, oh, okay, the crap is hitting the fan. This is bad. So Prince Wu has an idea of starting an evacuation. Yeah, Karen, how did you feel about kind of what was going on in Republic City and Wu's maybe different motives?
His selfish motives?
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty great that they allowed him to have a good idea. You know, unfortunate that it had to be because he basically did want to get into Korra's pants, but also that's just kind of Wu, so I don't blame him for it too much. I think it's just kind of part of the character, but I'm glad that he's not completely useless. I thought he was going to be completely useless this entire series, and he's stepping up a little bit. Might be for the wrong reasons, but it's still the right thing to do, and that's interesting. I wonder if by the end he's going to end up understanding what responsibility he has.
It is definitely a start. I don't think he's actually trying to get into Korra's pants because I think he's gay, but I think he's, you know, whatever, just hasn't come to terms with that fact yet. So we have a lot of this episode focuses on the relationship between Lin and Toph. It's like, you know, Lin calls her chief. They haven't seen each other in 20 years. It's like, you know, Toph has no kind of evident remorse about this, really. So Mitch, how did you feel about this difficult kind of relationship that exists here?
It hurts to watch because I like Toph, but we've already seen enough of her parenting to know that she's simply not a good parent. And yeah, she did end up with some great kids, as she says, but it really wasn't from her doing. It was almost just from like the kids deciding they wanted to be better. Like, I know Toph kind of sent Sue off to go, I guess, live with pirates or grandparents or something of that sort. What's the difference? And, you know, I think Lin just took up too strongly of her mother's personality to butt heads enough to make it not work. And it's sad. I just wish there was a happier ending here, but there really isn't. Like, everyone kind of comes to terms with their rough relationship with each other in the Beifong family. And I think it's just honestly better to look toward the brighter future of Sue's family and Lin, because they're much happier and they're much more connected, even with their little Percy Weasley. And they're going to be able to, you know, I think set up a good dynasty of Beifong's past. I suppose we could say Toph's half-baked dynasty that she kind of sort of doesn't want.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point that, you know, Toph is a bad parent. Like, you know, she's not an intentionally bad parent, but I think that the signs we get are, you know, pretty strong in that direction, that she was just not really cut out to be a generous figure, I guess, which is sad to learn, especially when you see her, you know, in Atla, and part of her journey is coming to be more selfless and rely on other people. And it seems like she couldn't really do that with her own kids. But the reason I bring that up is because I always felt very strongly that, you know, the suggestions that Aang was a bad father were off the mark. But I think they do give us an example of one of the gang just being a bad parent here, which, yeah, is sad. Brittany or Karen, any thoughts on the Toph issue?
I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to now put Aang back in the spotlight because he was still an awful parent, in my opinion. But it kind of made sense for Toph's character that she was kind of like, she doesn't know what to do when with others. Like, she never really knew what to do in Atla either. She was always kind of like almost just reaching the point of like learning something about working with other people. Like, she never like surpassed it in my mind. So like here, she's always just coming up short again and figuring it out. Like, well, if everyone seems happy, then okay, like I can just move on and go back to being alone by myself. But I don't think she really, now that her like friends are gone, like Sokka and Aang are gone, she wasn't ever really that close with Katara. So I feel like now that like her friends are gone, she's kind of like, well, I'm better off alone. I was fine alone before, like, well, she wasn't fine. Her parents were awful. But she's like, you know, she's done. She's done her job. She doesn't know what to do next. So she's just going to go away.
And I think she's earned the right to kind of go off into the swamp on her own after everything she's been through. I think that's unfortunate. It has to be at the cost of her children. But like we've been saying, she's not intentionally a bad parent. You know, it's not like she's abusive or she's intentionally setting out to hurt her kids. She just kind of doesn't really know what to do with them. And I mean, I'm not entirely sure why she had kids to begin with. I mean, it could have been an accident, but this is Nickelodeon, so they probably wouldn't get into that. But I think it's interesting.
But her children do have two different fathers, so I feel like there's room for that to be a possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just unfortunate, but I think, you know, now that she's getting older and everything, she is really doing the best that she can, and she's come to terms with herself, and she just kind of hopes that her kids can do that too, and I think they did in the end.
Yeah, oh, and I do want to, like, state, again, I don't think Toph was, like, intentionally a bad parent or, like, abusive or anything like that. I think she might have been neglectful just because that's maybe her personality, but I don't think she ever like intended to hurt her children or in any sense of the way. Just so that there's no confusion on that perspective. We do find out who Lin's father is in like a, like the most like let down slash like fan servicey moment ever. Because Bolin is like taking a script off of Tumblr and being like, who is her father though? And then she's like, oh yeah, it was this guy. And
I didn't like him anymore, so he went away.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that? Anyone disappointed that it wasn't Sokka?
I mean, I'm always disappointed that it wasn't Sokka. But then again, we didn't have to deal with a reminder that Sokka's dead again. So.
And also, we don't know Sue's father.
Yeah, so. And I had he is still Sue's father. Ugh. Damn you, Bright.
Well, is it too much of a spoiler to say, yeah, we don't know Sue's father by the end of the series, but maybe we'll find out in comics?
I guess we could find out in comics. I don't know if that would be one of the things we focus on, but...
Well, it's ridiculous because there was a family tree that Nickelodeon released for the entire series. It revealed, like, one or two little things, but I'm pretty sure it's a... Actually, you know what? I think it showed Sokka without any children. I'm 90% sure it did. Do you remember me saying that to you, Mikhail? I can... give it to whoever's reading the show notes, Karen, so you can link to it and people can check through. Because I don't think they'd be spoiled at this point. I mean, four episodes to the end, maybe, but, you know, whatever. So you guys can check out what we're talking about. But they have Kanto. They don't have a picture of them. And anyone who's basically, like, seen in, like, a picture or something, they did a really good job of organizing. But they still didn't reveal anything in it, and it really made me upset because I really wanted to know Sue's dad. But apparently it's not Sokka, if my memory serves correct.
Yeah. They like to keep these pieces of information, you know. I mean, people were bugging them for years about what happened to Zuko's mother, and they wouldn't go out and give a straight answer because they had a story there that they wanted to tell. So, another great moment, obviously, Bolin meeting Toph. That was definitely very, like, you know, meeting somebody at a convention that you really like. Absolutely. At least, did that happen to other people? Or?
Everything I had hoped for in him meeting Toph, it was perfect.
Yeah, it wasn't as great as him meeting Zuko, which I still think is much funnier than this moment, but this moment was a very close second.
Yeah, because Toph is definitely not going to tolerate it, you know? But, yeah, it is kind of funny to me to see, like, that Toph actually really has actually a close relationship with Opal. Yeah, that's her name. Sorry. She has a close relationship with Opal. And her granddaughter is an airbender, of all things. So, I don't know. I found that amusing for some reason.
It's like hanging out with Twinkle Toes again. She gets a little to bit. See, have an airbender in the family.
Yep. Yeah, she does. Okay, there's nothing about this that isn't sad.
I know. Like, we're getting towards the end, and not only is the show ending, but we're getting all of these, like, Avatar reminders thrown in.
Yeah. Yeah, it's feelings time for sure. We do, you know, Toph and Lin do eventually kind of come to an understanding through basically the rescue of the Beifongs. They use their powers together. You know, the whole family kind of gets in on the action. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Mitch, how did you feel about this particular rescue thing?
Well, there's a specific moment that I remember writing to you about Mikhail when this first aired, and I was like, did one of those twins just hit on Bolin? And I'm still pretty sure that it happened.
I felt it.
Yeah?
I think most people saw it.
And I was like, okay.
Had it
like,
on the cheek. It was, yeah.
Well, like, we had this Desna-esque which one's the girl, which one's the boy thing that Bolin was doing, and we're like, okay, so maybe he has, like, a fluid sexuality or he doesn't know it yet. And then this kind of led me on a bit, and I was just like, okay, well, something didn't work out with one of the Beifongs, so you might as well try out another. Like, go for it.
I don't think Bolin is interested. I think he definitely gave him a look that was like, what? Like, I'm dating your sister, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, and the end of this basically shows us that, like, you can't take down Toph Beifong because she basically handled everything. So it is kind of like the existence of Toph, and I guess maybe not Zuko. I don't know if he's as powerful. He never was like the best bender ever. But he, like, Toph does exist as this kind of, like, you know, ace in the deck that they don't play except for now, you know, because she is, like, so skilled at this. Yeah, I don't know. That was cool. Just seeing her, like, going up against this extremely modern problem and, like, sort of based around the idea that she had invented, you know, metal bending, which is brought up, actually, because she calls Bolin an idiot for not being able to metal bend. Brittany, how did you feel about that?
Well, she also pointed out the fact that some people catch on a little bit later, and then he was like, well, I can lava bend, and I'm like, all right, perfect. Like, he showed her anyway, so Toph just has expectations that cannot be met by any human being / bender ever, including her daughter, so just whatever. I just didn't take it as an insult, because that's just how Toph is, but Bolin still rocks, and maybe he can metal bend eventually, you never know.
Listen, Toph still had someone that could meet her expectations. That man was named Sokka.
Well, she already knew what his level, like, what level he could reach, and he did, you know.
Then it's also kind of funny, too, that Toph admits that this is such a rare skill. And I guess I never thought about it, because no one comments at all. No one's, like, to the effect where, you know, Toph was metal bedding, and they were like, whoa, like... It's weird because the way it all occurs, and I think the fact that he learns it from, like, an enemy, it's just kind of like, oh, yeah, that's a thing that some people can do, but it's still not that impressive because, like, what can you really do with it, I guess? I don't know. It feels like the reaction of everyone up until this point when Toph says that it's rare is so muted to the point that he's making lava.
Yeah. I don't know. The whole rare bending thing, you know, it's an interesting progression of the way things become, like, normal. And I mean, we saw it with lightning bending in the first season, right? So the other kind of partial plot of the episode is that while this is going on, basically Batar and Kuvira realize that Juli has been sabotaging their giant spirit bomb thing because she is a boss and was not actually loyal to them. So was anybody surprised to learn that Juli was actually the master of her own fate here?
Oh, please. She's too smart to ever switch sides.
Yeah. Although I was still, like, cheering anyway, because I was really happy that it played out that way.
Yeah, for sure. It almost doesn't end well, though, because Kuvira's like, okay, we're going to tie you up in the city that is right near this massive bomb, even though the bomb doesn't actually hit the city. Oh, wait, does Batar redirect the bomb? Does he, like, redirect?
No, it's one of the Beifongs does it. You don't really see who. It's off camera. Oh, okay. Maybe it's, like, the twins.
Right, okay. So we do see kind of, it's interesting that this is paired with the next episode, because in this episode, Batar does have, I mean, he's just as ruthless as Kuvira, basically. He has no, you know, compunction about killing Julie. But when he sees that Opal is in, you know, this little town that they're about to obliterate, he does kind of freak out and want them to stop. Obviously, you can't, because it's a massive spirit bomb, and you guys really shouldn't be playing with this stuff, because it's just not a good idea. Yeah. What else have we got going on, guys? This episode is kind of...
Well, so obviously this is all an allusion to, like, Einstein created the atom bomb and no one wanted to use it, except for the ones that were seen as being nefarious for a bit, and then that made Ryko want to use it again. I mean, I think in that episode, that's maybe the next episode that discussion happens, but it kind of starts here with, like, the doing, like... what's the name of the test that was done in the middle of the desert? Kinzberg test or something like that. Like, this felt like it was literally meant to represent, like, key by key World War II moments to me. And I think that that's not overdone, but I can't say that it excites me. It feels like I just felt this all, for instance, in, like, I don't know, even Harry Potter, to see, like, Voldemort's, you know, not killing all the Muggles and rounding them up and whatnot. And now we're here doing, like, the atom bomb storyline. And it feels like I'm kind of over it, I guess. I guess I am over it. I'm over, like, the allusions to World War II in media. I think that it's just a little bit overdone right now. What do you guys think, though?
I don't think I was really focusing on it that much. I mainly because I have a lot of, like, hopes set up for the next four episodes that aren't being met, like, things I want to see. So I guess I'm frustrated for different reasons, not so much that it's referring to World War II so much as I want to see, like, you know, like I said it earlier, this is sort of like one of those necessary evil episodes where, like, we have to get everybody back together and rescued and know what the real threat is and whose motivations lie where. And this episode did a great job of setting that up. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, okay, but I need all these things that I want to see resolved in three episodes. And maybe, like, Adiana says in the doc, like, maybe there'll be a Toph Zutara reunion, or, like, you know, I want to see certain things, not just at a ceremony at the end. Like, you know, am I ever going to see Boomy again? Probably not at this point. Book four was really disappointing on the Boomy front.
yeah, well, we'll see. But, I mean, I think I don't actually agree with you, Mitch. I think that, you know, this is a world that's in approximately World War One era. You know, it is the era of mass, of machinery, of death, of that kind of thing being created. Obviously, it's a little advanced with an analog to a nuclear bomb, but I think it's an important thing to deal with in that, like, I mean, we still have these issues. I think what Ryko says about, you know, basically, Varric is like, we can't use this. It's too powerful. And what's his face? Ryko is like, no, they're already using it. And that's basically, you know, that's a real argument. You know, how do you respond when people are using deadly weaponry around you? Obviously, we know how it went down in history, but, like, I don't think we're ever done dealing with that question. So I found it relevant, and because I don't think that there's, like, a right or wrong answer. And I think that, like, that's whenever you can put your, like, okay, sure, maybe it's, like, an easier right or no right or wrong situation to think of, because it's come from history, but I think it's still a good one. So, Karen, any
Yeah, I'm not saying it's bad. I definitely don't think it's anything that's, like, unpleasant. I just think I'm personally tired of it, in my own opinion. But I mean, I assume that I not everyone else can feel the same way, because I don't hear this complaint often with Korra or in general with anything alluding to World War II. I think that maybe I'm just burnt out because I took such a strong interest in World War II history for a while, and now I'm just like, okay, this is one too many. I'm done.
Could be. Any thoughts on that, Karen?
heavy
topic?
Yeah, it is a little bit, but I tend to really like storylines like this because I always find it fascinating the dynamic between humans and nature and humans feeling that they can control nature. And obviously the spirit vine thing has a little bit more than just Mother Nature there. There's like this elemental spiritual relationship between it, but the fact that Kuvira feels that she is powerful enough to control this weapon is fascinating to me because I think that her greed and her arrogance is going to be her downfall, and she's really messing with something that is way too powerful. And hopefully in the end, everything, you know, the people will realize that what she's doing is terrifying and shouldn't be done, and they'll have a greater respect for the spirits, for the spirit world, for nature in general. But I always like seeing that dynamic between the two because I think it's always relevant, those kind of storylines. You know, today, back then, even further back in the future, it's always going to be something that I think humans are going to be dealing with as we grow and populate the earth and try to feel like we can take over everything.
Yeah, for sure. And that's interesting in that it ties into what Korra tries to do with the spirits. You know, she kind of tries to recruit them to her side and argues for, you know, what seems to be a unified front. But they're, you know, the other spirit basically says, you're just trying to use us as weapons like Kuvira is. And Korra, I don't think she agrees with that interpretation, but she doesn't really have an argument against it because it's not a wrong argument to make, I think.
Yeah, it's all about intention, but even if you have the best intentions, it doesn't mean that what you're doing is the best way to go about it.
Right. And I mean, Kuvira, from her perspective, you know, obviously she does a lot of evil things, but she's built a super weapon so nobody can kind of hurt the Earth Kingdom, right? Nobody would dare to attack the Earth Kingdom now. You know, she's the only one in charge of it, and she thinks she's doing all good things. So from that perspective, you know, I'm not agreeing with her, but I, you know, you could see where that like thread of argument might take you. So, you know, the episode does end on kind of a sweet note where we have Toph mentioning that her back hurts and she doesn't want to fight anymore, and that's why Katara did not get involved in the Civil War stuff, which is another, like, definitely note from the writers, you know, like, that's why, guys, that's why, because she's old, and she doesn't want to fight anymore. So Ariana disagrees with this, and she says that we know that Katara loves getting all up in everybody's business, but perhaps she has mellowed over the years. Any thoughts? That was a nice callback to Katara. I liked it.
Yeah, like, it's crazy because I actually didn't recognize the fact that Katara wasn't fighting, I suppose, during the Civil War. Unless if I did, then I'm totally biting my tongue. But maybe I just kind of forgot. And I feel like that this brought, like, a fourth wall up in front and center to say, like, basically, that's the reason you didn't see Katara fight in the Civil War, to say, fandom, stop talking about it. It's done. It's over with. She wasn't there. And it's weird that they brought attention to it because I feel like that made it worse almost. But I don't know. Macaw, was there a big like rise in the fandom to say like, what's Katara doing this whole time? You know, why, especially the Civil War, I suppose. Was that a thing people concentrated on?
I think it was. I think people were upset that they didn't have her there, didn't explain why. I mean, I think it's, you know, I think it's a so-so explanation, I guess. Like, the real reason is because this is about Korra and her and the younger generation. But, you know, it's sort of like, again, the ace in the stack. It is a little sad because we did see, you know, the old guys, like, really kicking ass in the finale of Avatar. So it is sort of sad that we don't really see that, you know, now, or earlier with Katara. But, you know, I mean, they had very difficult, long, traumatic lives. So I can understand that Katara might have just been like, I am retiring from war. That is not happening anymore. I'm not going to be a part of that. That makes
sense. She's still healing. It's not like she's not working full time still. Because look at her. She's running like physical therapy, and she's also teaching on these new healers how to do their thing. She always sets up like a triage whenever there's a war going on. I feel like she's doing plenty. I don't need to see her fighting, because I think, like Toph's saying, like, you get to a point where you just don't want to be up and moving and physical as much. It just hurts. Your osteoporosis and your joints and your arthritis just all kind of give out.
Yeah, for sure. Any other thoughts on Katara, or I guess the rest of this episode? Any points that anyone wants to bring up?
Anything I like the next episode better.
Yeah.
Do we have confirmation that Zuko's over there protecting his daughter again? We just assume that's what he does whenever there's a war or something going on.
I don't know.
Because like I think he's fairly absent from this finale.
She can hold her own though. Like he might be just on Ember Island kicking it, you know.
Yeah, like he's probably done with this war
too. She seems like pretty in control of what's going on. Was this the episode where we see General Iroh arrive with the troops?
No, that's the next episode. Don't you find it?
I definitely like the next one better. I was like, oh, maybe I do have something to talk about. Nope.
Well, I just find it weird that Zuko will go out, and maybe this was his final bang, to like go out and.
Well, he would be with Katara if it was his final bang.
I set myself up for that one. That's where he is. But no, Red Lotus escape. He was there for Please Escape, and it makes no sense to me that he would get involved in that, but then not in this. Maybe, like I was saying, you know, his final shebang, we'll call it.
Well, he was around for a couple of other things, but not really, like, they weren't making a big deal about his presence, as we were on the podcast. Well, I was on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I think he probably is acting as a guard for his daughter, not that she doesn't have people to, you know, guard her or take care of her or anything like that, or isn't capable of taking care of herself, although we actually have no idea if she's a bender or not. But I'm assuming that she's Maya's daughter, so she probably can kick ass with those like bladey things.
Zuko was always better at parkour than anything, so can you imagine that parkour baby?
Yes. Yeah, Izumi is one of my like favorite characters who's not really actually a character at all, exclusively pretty much because I think she's Zuko and May's daughter. But yeah, I mean, I love that. I love that Zuko seems to be a really good father, you know, and a good parent when we have a lot of complicated parent things, and Zuko came from like the most messed up situation of anybody. Not that anyone lacked for dysfunction for sure in Avatar.
But he had Iroh, so he probably like internalized a lot of that.
True.
And used it to help his parenting. But maybe, like, I think the last time we saw him was when Korra was like, hey, I hung out with Iroh for a little bit. So maybe he's, like, trying to get into the spirit world to go have some tea with his uncle.
Yeah.
But can you just imagine what a full circle it would have been if it's almost kind of like our like a weird way of getting Zutara, if we had Korra get with General Iroh, because it's, like, you know, he's voiced by Dante Bisco. She's, like, a waterbender with some weird hair. It's almost there. It's like halfway Zutara. I still would have been happy with that.
I still ship it. I mean, General Iroh is not a sight for sore eyes. So he's,
but it's sad that he doesn't talk in the next episode. I don't remember if he talks in the next two after that.
Yeah,
but
he talks a little bit because he tells her that like she has to go get back to her city. Yeah, he talks.
But I know Dante Bisco is such a big fan of the series, and that role meant a lot to him to have to come back, because it was like his shining moment. That and Rufio, so, you know.
Well, you know. Pretty sure Rufio ranks a little bit higher than Iroh. I mean, Zuko's up there, but.
Yes.
Anyway, cool. Let's move on into our favorite scenes and lines. Mitch, what was your favorite scene?
Okay, so my favorite scene is when the twins are working together to save Sue, and they connect their metal bending ropes to attach to each other. I love the way that that's shot, and I love, like, emotional family teamwork. It really gets me every time in battles.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very cool for sure. Brittany, how about you?
Mine was when you hear Toph and Lin, like, arguing across the campfire, and Balin is just, like, shoveling, like, the instant noodles. And they're just like hanging out of his mouth, and his eyes just keep moving back and forth between the argument. It was so funny.
Listen, how good did those noodles look?
I know, it's like instant ramen. I was like, where did they get these?
I know, it was funny because they even had like the little like plastic lid on top.
Yeah. From the drunk noodle shop.
Did they just go to Walmart or something? Like
in the first season, the noodle shop.
I don't remember. I'll believe you.
When they go on their date.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's the one that we found the recipe of one day. That's cool.
Karen, how about you?
Sue and Kuvira's fight, because my God, that was done so beautifully and it was so intense. And I just love the fact that whenever you think of the big players on the show, they're all women. It's all like Sue and Kuvira and Lynn and Korra. And it's just so exciting. And that fight, you know, I really didn't know what was going to happen, who was going to win. I had absolutely no idea. And whenever that happens, it's always exciting.
Yeah. Definitely. And mine was Julie standing up to Kuvira, because I thought that was awesome. And I love both of these ladies, and I love that they're both kind of so strong and like, you know, one's on the good side, one's on the bad side, but they're both just like totally unimpressed by anyone trying to intimidate them or whatever. So I really dug that. Mitch, what was your favorite line?
My favorite line is, "Toph, what's up with him, Lynn? He's an actor." That's cute.
I was trying to figure out if they were, like, throwing shade with that line, or... Oh, yeah.
No, they absolutely were toward, like, Hollywood in general, just to say, like, you're so full of yourself. That's what I interpreted.
It's also kind of an old-fashioned, like, when Hollywood started, like, people had a very low opinion of actors. Like, they were, like... a step up from like prostitutes for a while. And this is also the beginning of Hollywood. I don't know if that's implied. Maybe it's just shade, but who knows? Brittany, how about you?
Mine was when Bolin met Toph and he's like, "Oh man, oh, I can't, this can't be happening." And then he's like doing this like dance and Toph's like, "Do you have to pee?" And he's like, "No, well now maybe."
Karen, what was yours?
That scene was like very close second, but my absolute favorite was when Toph said, "You give metalbenders a bad name." I don't know why, but I started crying. I'm like really emotional about it. And then later when she says, "At some point you got to leave it to the kids," it got worse and it got kind of gross. So yeah, I don't know why, but Toph made me cry this episode.
Okay, yeah. Did y'all sing the song? Did you know what song I'm talking about, right?
You Give Love a Bad Name.
Yes, thank you. I'm pretty sure that there's a Tumblr post out there, at least 500 times worth of a Tumblr post out there of that.
Probably.
It's too obvious. That's just, I really do feel like sometimes this show just sets itself up so strongly for Tumblr, it's crazy. And I wouldn't put it past break.
Yeah, definitely. It took place in a weird, it was created in kind of a weird, self-aware little vacuum for a while there. So my favorite line was the spirit to Korra, when he says, "What you want is exactly what Kuvira wants, to use spirits as a weapon in a human war." And cause that line gave me a lot to think about. And, you know, I think Korra has a good point too, that like, hey, we're trying to live with you guys, so like you could help us out from like being destroyed and stuff. And the spirit also has a good point that like, where does it end? If you use, you know, these spiritual resources, what, like, where does it stop? Where do you draw the line? I don't know. I found it very interesting. So moving on to chapter 11, Kuvira's Gambit, or the episode that Brittany liked. In this episode, Julie proves that step off Korra. She is the real hero of the story. Meanwhile, Mako gives very specific instructions, but because people are basic, Prince Wu's soothing lullaby voice is really what they need to get hopping. Also, Batara Jr., learns the tough love lesson, the tough lesson that when a bitch is cray, you can't love a cray bitch. Also, some other stuff happened in this episode, like they captured Batar. They were going to attack Kuvira. They thought she was going to attack in 2 weeks. Kuvira moved up the timeline and starts approaching with this massive thing, this massive metal bending mecha suit thingy that's like a million stories tall and everything. So they're all freaking out and try to go take it out from behind enemy lines, but that doesn't work. They don't, whatever. They end up capturing Batar, and Korra is like, they're trying to get information from him, and he and Sue have a very sad and emotional conversation. And seriously, these episodes are just so depressing if you think about them for more than 5 seconds. And Korra threatens him with basically like carrying him around like a knapsack for the rest of her life to keep him away from Kuvira. And so he tells Kuvira that they have to basically surrender and just leave off conquering Republic City and going back to their normal, you know, place. And so Kuvira fires the Colossus on their little warehouse, possibly killing not only everyone, but also the man she is engaged to. So that's intense.
Maybe. Here's a newbie theory right now. If I was a newbie, I would say Kuvira did this on purpose to kill the Avatar, not in the Avatar state, so that the next Avatar would be the Earthbender that she could now rise up in power with. Dun, dun, dun. It's not a good newbie theory, if only I didn't know how it ended.
I don't know. What did the newbies think?
That is interesting.
Yeah, if I didn't know the final frame of the series, I'd be a little more concerned.
Doesn't hashtag the thing just ruin everything? Natalie revealed it last week. Can we talk about that? That it's now out? We don't have to talk about it, but
we gave a huge warning saying like you could turn it off if you want to listen to it. So we can't really talk about it because people still might not want to listen to it. So literally next week we could talk about it.
Yes.
Next
week. If we did all this time, we can wait one little bit more.
We could talk about it next week.
Yeah.
There's not that much to talk about.
Well, just the fact that we can all say it out loud.
Yes, we can all. We should. We should have a chorus.
It'll be like a countdown, like 1, 2, 3, blank.
Anyway, so this episode is, seriously intense. We have some lightheartedness with Julie kind of, like, going back, like, contritely to Varric, but also definitely not letting him walk all over her again, which I found to be a huge relief. Any thoughts on that particular storyline? She's like, dude, I'm not your slave.
Oh,
like,
I ship it so hard. It's so good. Yeah. Varric, like the first time he sees her, like his face just changes and I'm like, oh, this is going to happen. And then he like slips into his old self and I'm like, oh, so sad. But Julie like sticks up for us. Oh, so good. So good. I love that whole plot line of how she's just like not taking anyone's shit anymore.
Yeah, for sure. She has had a lifetime of shit taking. So
yeah, and also Varric, like he's sort of changed a little bit too, just in the fact that he's recognizing that what he created is like a huge problem. So, and he's like really working hard to like change those mecha suits to like with Asami to things that could fly, and what are they, hummingbirds, I think, or something like that. They're trying to change them too. Yeah, I thought that was really, really cool that they're using what they have and that the non-benders are becoming the most important like part of this plot right now. So that's kind of cool. Like their success kind of hinges on their ability to get these things off the ground as quickly as possible.
And I find that kind of circular to season one, where Imam was saying that, you know, the world's better without benders. And he was able to almost prove that with the use of technology, with his mech suits and with his shocky sticks and super acrobatic moves. It's really cool to almost see the benders become irrelevant in a world where they're so powerful. But then again, we do have Kuvira controlling a giant mech suit with metal bending, so it's still going
to
be relevant for a while.
At the end of the day, it's going to come down to there has to be balance. That's the whole point of this series, I think, is like, you know, they even say it in the opening, like there has to be balance in the world. And
the book is called Balance.
Yeah, and yeah. These are all like, I think it's really good that they keep coming back to all these moments where it's like, oh, well, clearly the benders are the ones that are going to save the day. And clearly it's the non-benders that are going to save the day. But it always comes down to a combination of the two, which I think is cool. Except for poor Asami, who like went away for a really long time.
Yeah, but what the heck? Like she had like a very poignant moment with her father. She had a really cute reunion with Korra. And then she just disappeared for like two episodes.
Well, no, she's been working on these things with Varric, which is since.
Yeah, that's right. Because there was that really busy episode that happened. Remember, Brittany of Virtue was episode 8, I think, or no, 9, excuse me, where it's so busy and like so much happens. And then they kind of shove in the fact that Varric and Asami are working together amongst that. So I guess they kind of just got lost in the details of like everything being set up.
She's been like really busy working reluctantly with Varric, but they're making it happen.
It's good that they shared that reluctance, because I think I would have been pretty upset if they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also have, sort of along the same lines, the evacuation of the now mandatory evacuation of Republic City, which stars Mako and Wu, kind of being opposite sides of the effectiveness coin there. Was anybody surprised that Wu's speech actually succeeded in getting the people calm? What did you feel about that, Karen?
I wonder how much of the city is like Bolin's grandmother, where they kind of just like really look up to the royal family, and it doesn't matter what they say or do, they always are gonna kind of be in love with them. So I think the fact that Wu like got down on their level and was like, sometimes I'm afraid to go to the bathroom by myself too, but it's okay, we can all, you know, be happy together or whatever, but we need to leave the city. I felt it just kind of made sense in the moment. And if the city is anything like Bolin's grandmother, they would be like, oh man, yeah, this totally makes sense, we really need to leave now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I love that Republic City has these ridiculous evacuation manuals that are like completely pointless. And if you have so many segments in the city, you should have individualized books with like appointed leader. Never mind. Forget it. That's, yeah. We're getting into bureaucratic infrastructure now. But yeah, so the emotional heart of the episode is definitely, you know, the Beifong capture of Batar. They're kind of trying to bring him back into the family fold. As Ariana puts it, somebody needs to knock some sense into that fuckboy. So I don't know. I found this whole thing very sad and moving that, like, you know, especially Batar's conversation with Sue, that she is kind of, she's at her most humble here, and she's really kind of trying to speak to him on his level and bring him back into her family in whatever way he wants to be. And he, you know, is just too hurt or too stubborn or a combination of those, too angry. You know, he really is enthralled by this idea of a life that he has with Kuvira, and he refuses her. And I found that really sad.
Too brainwashed? Do you think that Kuvira brainwashed him? Not in like a, you know, stick him in front of a television and like electrocute him kind of way, but sort of gave him everything he wanted in order to turn him against his family and keep him at her side?
I think so, but at the same time, I'm kind of still curious as to like how, like, there's like this huge gap in my head. Maybe I'm just forgetting about something that happened in an episode where, like, how he went from working with his dad during that dinner and, like, whatever to this. Like, I just don't see, like, why he's so obsessed with her. And I think what you're saying, Karen, is probably true. Like, he was probably just, like, given all these false promises and then, you know.
You know, given that we're working with the Earth Nation, when I was first watching this, I had the impression that he was actually hypnotized by the Dai-Li and then brainwashed into believing that Kuvira is the ultimate leader. But, I mean, we didn't see the Dai-Li past them kind of being dumb with the Red Lotus. I wish the Dai-Li was better.
Maybe they're in the camps or something. Like, maybe she, like, used him as her first camp test subject.
Because it works really well.
Seems to genuinely care about him at some moments, even though she cares about having power more, is what it boils down to.
That's what I was thinking, because I was, like, watching those last few frames, I was like, okay, she is actually emotional about this. So she cares about him on some level, but it's just she cares about taking over Republic City more than she cares about him.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what I think, you know, my perspective of it. I don't think there was brainwashing going on. I think that there was, I mean, I do definitely think, you know, she was very influential on him and, you know, tapped into feelings that maybe he wasn't aware of or hadn't really given attention before. But I think that, I don't think that Kuvira took something that wasn't there or like put something into Batar that didn't already exist. I think that she exploited, you know, his desire to be recognized and to be, you know, his own person and, or, you know, somebody in charge. And she then delivered on that, you know. I mean, he's her second in command. He is her fiance. He has everything that he thinks he wants. So I think that, you know, and I definitely agree. I think that there was some like definite like villainizing of Sue and of their life in Zhaofu for sure. But I don't think it's like, oh, she brainwashed him, blah, blah, blah. You know, if it were that, I wouldn't be impressed with it. I don't think that that's interesting or complicated. I think that this is much deeper and much more emotional, and that Batar really believes that Kuvira loves him. And I agree with you guys. I think Kuvira does love him, but I think that Kuvira is a really complicated person who has a lot of competing desires, let's just say.
Can we even go as far to say that maybe she looked at Batar Jr., saw him as a prime person to gain power with, to use the mind of, to backstab Sue with? So she kind of picked him up and said, okay, whatever, like, maybe there'll be some hot sex, this'll be cool. And then eventually she really got into it and actually loved him, but then she had to, like, sacrifice him much, not much like, but somewhat similar to what Sihir did when he let go of his earthly tether, you know, when he watched Pali die. Because they even have a scene much like Pali and Zaheer do, like, you know, it's the same frame, it's looking at them from the side, they kiss, one's taller than the other, and then they're like, I love you so much, no matter what, we'll get married after this. And then basically Batar, well, okay, I'm stopping right there, because I know what happens past this episode. Anyways, it's just, I think it's more evident to me that she was using him, and then she ended up liking him, but then she was able to go back to realizing, oh, you know what, he was just a pawn this whole time. Like, it would have been nice to keep him around, he's really smart, we would have beautiful babies, but it's just not worth it.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, she's learned from Sue, you know, and Sue, to a certain extent, is also a manipulator and a user of people, obviously to a much, like, you know, better extent. Sue manipulates people into doing her bidding to make Zhaofu a really awesome place, you know, but that element of the personality still exists. Which is why I think there's so much enmity there between those two characters, because they are similar. I don't know. It's hard to like say exactly what Kuvira really thinks of her relationship with Batar, but I do think that that scene in the cockpit of the Colossus thing are really fascinating to me, because they aren't just the actions of somebody who is making a super easy decision. She's making a decision that she chooses herself, right? And she definitely chooses her goals and her desires and her end game, which is, you know, obviously partly what she believes is best for the Earth Kingdom Empire thing. You know, it's obviously harder and harder to make that argument now when you're attacking an independent city, although What's-Her-Face did make the same argument, the Earth Queen. So, I don't know. I don't think it's as important what, like, the specific nature of their relationship was, as much as, like, the clear evidence that there was caring there, and there is definite regret in Kuvira's eyes and her face when she pulls that trigger. And I don't necessarily think she would have done it if Korra hadn't been there. You know, like, definitely she thought that there was a cost-benefit analysis here that weighed in the benefit of pulling the trigger. I don't know, newbies, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, whenever it comes to Korra, Kuvira has sort of been single-minded, so I think you're right. I think it makes sense that just the fact that Korra was there kind of drove her over the edge and forced her hand. It was always going to be a hard decision, but in the end, she did kind of make that decision rather swiftly, and I think Korra was a big part of that.
Yeah, and I think that the, like I was saying earlier, like, the lure of power outweighs anything else. So if Korra's in the way, or, I mean, if Batar's in the way of Korra, then, like, she can maybe find love again, or just spend a life grieving, but she'll have all the power that she wants.
Yeah, and that's why I really like Kuvira as a character, because she, obviously, you know, I would never, ever, ever argue that the things she does are good or are right or any, you know, any incarnation of that at all. She's a ruthless person. She does terrible things. But I understand why, and I not only understand why, I think her decision-making process is interesting. So, I don't know. I know a lot of people really don't like Kuvira, but and I don't think you're supposed to like love Kuvira, but that's kind of why I am into her as a character. So that's definitely that. I mean, this episode definitely ends with a bang on that particular note. What do you guys think is going to happen next? I mean, based on what you do know, hashtag the thing, certain people are maybe not dead, but do you think there are any casualties of this explosion? What do you think? Yeah, what do you think?
I mean, I think that they're kind of in an abandoned part of Republic City right now, so maybe the president will die. Who knows? Or maybe Varric has something up his sleeve that he could use. I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone is actually going to die out of our major players. There might be like a side unspoken death, but I do think that they're all going to make it out alive. And then Batar's going to be like, yo, what are you doing to me? I thought we had a good thing going and then you tried to blow me up. Like, what gives? Yeah, so I think that'll happen. And then I think that Bumi's going to come and he's going to save everyone. And Tenzin's going to be like, listen, my brother's just the best. I'm so sorry I ever doubted you. I'm going to give you your tattoos now because you're an awesome airbender. And then, you know, he's going to become the new leader of the Air Nation because he deserves it.
Okay, cool. Aaron. Is that also your theory?
not quite. It's a good theory, though. I'm seriously wondering if one of Sue's kids is going to die, and that Batar, obviously Kuvira shooting the weapon at him is kind of, you know, he knows where the line is in the sand now, but if one of his siblings dies, I feel like that's going to be the driving factor for him going back to the family. I think it would make a lot of sense if that was the one thing that kind of made him realize what he's doing and the repercussions for what he's done. I mean, he clearly cared about Opal enough that, you know, he did not want her to be there. And so if, I don't know if she's going to die, I hope she doesn't die. That would be really sad. But if one of the other ones did, you know, maybe that would be like him. He would go back to his mother and just be like, all right, I get it now. I did not do a good thing.
She'd be like, wow, thanks. I'm so glad that you realized that now. Yeah, I don't know. Mitch, is there anything that you maybe don't remember that you're wondering about? I kind of remember this pretty clearly, but it was like almost exactly a year ago, which is kind of crazy at this point. But
I know it's weird how the timing matched up for a lot of Atla and Korra. It was just strange for us to like rewatch them or whatever. I have a question for the newbies, and it's something that I half remember, so this might count. Who, if anyone, do you think is going to die in this battle against Kuvira?
Probably like Batar, just so that she feels bad about something, even though, because he'll come back and then she'll be like, oh, okay, my plan didn't work. And then he'll die and she'll be like, oh, now I'm actually sad.
Aww. See, I don't know if she cares that much. I mean, I think she cares, but I don't know. I don't see that making, like, an emotional impact on her.
Well, I don't think anyone's death's going to make an emotional impact on her, so I picked the one player that I think would. Because I just don't think anyone else is going to die. I just have a strong feeling about it. Not that I know anything. Like, this isn't even a spoiler-related thing. I just really I hate to say it, but I feel like everything else has been, like, anticlimactic, that nothing else is going to happen. We only have two episodes left.
Do you think it's important, newbies, that either Kuvira follows the form of Zaheer or of Unalaq and Noatak? Like, do you want him to live? Do you want her to live or die? What's more important for a Korra villain in that you know, two of ours have already died, arguably three, if you count Tarlok.
I was actually thinking about this earlier because I was like, will Korra kill her? Like, that's not usually her shtick, but Kuvira has gained so much power, and she is such a powerful bender. I mean, I guess the other ones were too, that they had kept up in those specialty prisons, but I guess I kind of don't see Kuvira giving up or surrendering or allowing herself to be captured. So I would be surprised if she survived.
Or
do you think she'll?
Oh,
go ahead.
No, it's okay. You can do a follow-up question.
Do you think Kuvira will die if she is to die at someone else's hand or her own, given that we've had a very strong suicide theme, especially within villains, going on in the show?
I don't know. That's a good question. I feel like she'd be less likely to do it herself. She would be more likely to just continue fighting until they kind of forced her down, but I wouldn't put it past her.
Interesting.
I think it's going to parallel the end of Avatar, and it's just going to be like where they capture Azula and put her somewhere because she's going absolutely insane. Because she was a powerful bender, and they didn't kill her. And then we learned about what happened to her in the comics, apparently. I didn't read them yet. It's been like 2 years, still haven't read them.
Well, Mikal, correct me if I'm wrong here. I think we've just been able to understand that since Aang can do it, Korra could do it, taking away someone's bending. You were saying reflecting Atla. Do you think it's also a potential that instead of killing, she could do the Ozai route and just take away Kuvira's bending?
Could be.
Look at all these potentials I'm setting up. You don't know which one's real. No. Maybe I haven't even said the real one yet.
I will say that it's an interesting ending. It's definitely an interesting ending.
It is. I think it's safe to say that they don't know what to expect because it's just interesting. Yeah. You'll be pleasantly surprised, hopefully. I think I was.
And the bending is insane.
Thank goodness. Oh, yeah. Honestly, everyone could die as long as the bending's great.
So there is some bending that's bending. Really like, okay, wow.
Yeah, I love a good bending scene. So, I mean, at this point, it's whatever.
Oh, Britt, buckle down.
He's not been around for a couple episodes. I'm just disappointed all over the place.
There's there are gifts that I will share with you of fights that are about to happen once you've watched the episode, and I think you always seem to appreciate my gifts, and I'll send you that, and or maybe Karen, I can do another one of those like best moments and gifts things. Those are fun.
Yeah.
Oh, and then can I finally watch the trailer?
Yes. You can finally watch the trailer. You still can't watch it. You would still get spoiled.
Darn. Why do they release trailers like that then?
That's, I know. Nicole, you know why she would be spoiled, right? You have the thing
in mind. I don't remember.
We'll tell you later, Brittany, what would have been spoiled when you watched it.
Right. I didn't watch it. I loved the book 3 trailer so much.
They're so beautiful, but they've ruined the whole show. They make it a lot less entertaining. It sucks.
Yeah. Well, I won't watch it. I can wait. I can wait a week.
Well, there's just a lot of, I don't know. There's a lot of emotion in the finale. There's a lot of, short conversations, but conversations that have a lot of weight when they happen.
And we were told by Bright going into the finale, this will not be a large battle / a bend fest. And that's exactly what they said to us. That's kind of just what I'm presenting it.
Is it what they said? I don't remember that.
Yeah, I remember.
There's a lot of bending.
There is. So, I mean, who on that? Because I don't know what they were coming from with that. They were like, they essentially said there's like no action and this is just going to be a calm ending. And what? I mean, would you anticipate that at this point even having the potential of being a calm ending? I mean, come on, there's like this giant laser ripping through the city.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot that needs to happen. So you need a little bit of bending. You need a lot of emotional heart to heart. People got to figure out how they feel about things and what the future is going to be like. Because now everyone's dead, probably. So, you know, who knows?
Is this our one final hope for Sitara, then?
Well, it's the one final hope to actually see them on screen together. But, yeah.
And we do have Korra comics, so you never know.
Never know. I would just like a spinoff of them and just the gang kids. That's really all I want. Just all, like, you know, just, like, from, like, their, like, you know, however old they are at the end of whatever current comics are there. And then I just want some spinoffs of them.
Can I say how happy it made me, Brittany, too, kind of on a side note, when I heard you say last week, I think, that you were really impressed by, yeah, the Fire Nation's always been sexy, but the Earth Nation has really, like, ramped it up this whole series. And I think that's
really that might have been Adiana, but I definitely backed that up because it's so true. The Earth Nation is just so hot this season, and the bending is so good that, like, I almost don't miss firebending. Right. But I really do. Like, I would like this whole final battle. Like, I want them all to, like, okay, new theory. I want them all to retreat and, like, panic and get to the Fire Nation, because the Fire Nation's the only one that's, like, not coming after the Earth Nation right now. Because Izumi was like, no, I'm not getting involved. So it's the perfect cover for them to go there, because they're like, well, the Fire Nation wants nothing to do with us, so we're not going to bother them. And then they're all there, just chilling, hanging out, having a good time. Mm-hmm.
Well, that pretty much, yeah, takes us to the end of this episode. We are, I guess, getting into the, yeah, we're going into the finale, guys. I don't know if I'll be here next week, but somebody will for sure. Anyway, let's move on to our favorite scenes for the second to last time. Mitch, what's your favorite scene?
Okay, so my favorite scene in this episode is a really good one. It's really fun. It's I don't know why I find this very fun. It's really sadistic of me to like this, but they unabashedly kill two guards that are on lookout, and they don't even show them with parachutes or anything. They're just like, nope, they're like melted, goodbye. And I was like, yes, I love this intensity, just keep it coming.
Yeah, I forgot if that was in this episode or not, but yeah. that's the first time it's like, okay, yeah, those guards were roasted. Yep. Okay. Brittany, how about you?
Mine was when Wu took over and got the entire city to evacuate in an orderly fashion, because it's nice to give him something to do besides complaining or hiding or something. Because I think he's been around now. We might as well give him something to do.
Yeah. That is true. That is true. Karen, what about you?
Mine was when the Earth Empire guards, like, they didn't know where Batar was, and they were like, what do we do now? And they kind of looked to the president for help, and he's like, God, really? I have to handle this too? And he, like, took the radio from them, and they were like, yes, sir. And I was like, where does your loyalty lie exactly? And just the most powerful person or what? But they were kind of clueless, and it was very funny.
Yeah. And my favorite scene was the conversation between Kuvira and Batar at the end, because I spoke at length about that, but yeah, I really like that scene. And favorite lines, Mitch.
Okay, so my favorite line from my last episode, I'll be on to recap of Korra, last time I ever do this, is Bolin. I know what happens next. We got to get out of here now. And it shows such a growth that he's learned things and he's able to kind of protect the now group of dummies who are just sitting there waiting to be hit by a laser, apparently. And it was just so cool to see him be the one in charge, him be the one in the know, and to, I guess, have the power here. That really made me happy.
Yeah. Brittany, what was yours?
Mine was Lynn coming back, or Julie. Why did I say Lynn? We haven't seen Lynn since last episode. Yeah, mine is Julie coming back at Varric saying, no, I'm not your assistant anymore. If you want me around, you need to start treating me like an equal. She deserves it. She's awesome.
She is awesome. Yeah. Julie for president, for sure. Definitely over Raiko. Oh, my God. Karen.
Mine kind of goes along with Mitch's, because Mitch, I really loved that line, too. And yeah. It's when... Mako asks him if he knew about the giant mecha suit, and he goes, oh, did I forget to mention it? No, I didn't know. And he just got really angry, and it was so funny. And I was like, I mean, Mako deserved that. That was a pretty stupid question. I would think Bolin would have told him if he knew they were making that.
Yeah, that was a good one. That definitely, I heard that and I was like, oh, that might go on the list. But the one I chose was Mako's hilariously, like, ridiculous speech. I'll just read out the whole thing, because it probably is my last episode of Rewatchable. So, attention, citizens of Republic City, this is not a test. An attack on our city is imminent. President Raiko has ordered a mandatory evacuation for all citizens. Please find your evacuation handbooks and turn to subsection 1-26. There you will find initial instructions on your area. Initial instructions, mind you. For example, if you live in Northwest Vector 1, report to your primary meeting location, which would be at the eastern entrance of the Southern Water Tribe Library. There, you will choose a leader specified in section 1-28. And then the radio operator says, Chief, we're getting confused calls from all over the city. I think Mako was starting a panic. And that's just so perfect, because Mako would never intentionally start a panic, but causes a panic through his sheer devotion to order. And I love it so much. Awesome. So if you would like to get into contact with us again for the very last episode of Korra on Rewatchable, I don't know if we're doing a wrap-up episode after
we
that.
We are. Yeah.
We are. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the second to last episode, but our last episode talking about episodes, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave a comment on this post on hypeable.com. You can come and hang out with us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. And you can leave us an iTunes review. If you rate us 5 stars, then we will have a moving conversation with you before we blast you to pieces.
Okay.
So, whatever. Cool. So, getting into some listener feedback, we had some comments on the post from last week. TARDIS77, I'm sorry about Doctor Who, said, here's some interesting facts about the show. Maria Bamford, the voice of Pema, also voices Ryu's mom. Ryu is the, like, hipster, hilarious guy. In the commentary for the show, the creators reveal that Izumi has a daughter who is General Iroh's sister, and that they had planned for her to have a relationship with Mako, but ran out of time. That's cool. I'm glad that they might have run out of time on that, though, because too much relationships, too much. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad, hopefully Mako ends up with somebody nice in the future, but I don't need to see it. Mitch, you want to take Brittany Kuza?
Sure. Brittany Kuza wrote, Kuvira just loves the Zaufu so much, that she had to send a fully armed battalion to remind them of her love. I've been listening to Hamilton nonstop for 2 weeks, so I got behind and rewatchable. Sorry for the late reference. Brittany, this one's for you.
Yeah.
And call and Karen. Yeah. Not me. I shouldn't have read that one.
This is literally a comment for anyone but Mitch. Pretty
much. So I guess it's good that we had him read it.
I'd like to say that any Hamilton reference is never too late, so please keep them coming.
Yeah. I take it the Zaufu was on purpose.
No, that really is either a typo or just kind of like the Zaufu, like the NYC.
Right, okay, yeah. I didn't know if it was like a lyric specifically, like, say, the Americas or something.
Oh, no. Brittany, you want to take the first Twitter?
Sure.
So actually, you know what, Karen, you read
Karen
this
Karen should definitely take that one, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, in reference to Karen not revealing the next rewatchable show, Allie, I think this is the meanest Karen has ever been. Oh.
It's not. It's not, because Karen started the episode by revealing what the next rewatchable is going to be. Yay! It was when you posted that picture of it all blacked out.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. It took me a long time to do that, so I'm glad that
people, I loved it, because I fell for it, because Karen was like, I'm going to tweet something about the next, like, thing, and I was like, oh, awesome, she's going to announce it, and then I saw the tweet, and I'm like, ooh, that's harsh, man.
You guys are going to need a big crew for Buffy, though.
I mean, we're going to have the usual 8 hosts, but there are quite a few backups, so hopefully we'll be able to switch some people in and out and give everybody a good chance, because I know that Buffy is so beloved.
Oh man, I don't know anything about Buffy. I wonder if I'm gonna be on it. I'm still gonna run the Twitter even if Karen doesn't let me on, just because.
Have you ever not been a newbie, Brittany?
Yeah, Freaks and Geeks and Pushing Daisies, so
two
evenly split.
Cool. Yeah, I don't think I'm gonna do Buffy because I don't have that time, and also I watched it already, and I'm sure you have no need of whatchamacallits super fans, even though I'm not really a super fan. Anyway,
I'm gonna feel old by saying this. This is my 5th rewatchable show if I was to get on. So like, I'm going to be super like old and wizened and super in the know, you know, like I'll know exactly like the tropes. Like we'll be able to call back to like Veronica Mars days and I'll be like, yeah, I remember that.
Well, I mean, I'm like Karen. You're running out of time, Mitch.
That comment was for everyone but Mitch.
So Brittany, you want to take Kelsey Pays?
Yeah, Kelsey Pays said, at Rewatchable, so we can all channel our inner Varric. And she sent us this glorious photo that she found of like a bear sleeping bag that you can like your head.
The scariest thing I've ever seen.
Out of the mouth. And it's awesome. You can literally be Varric in this thing. It's so cool. I want one.
You could give somebody an actual heart attack with it.
Just to see if I ever were to ever go to a Comic-Con, which will probably never happen, I would cosplay as Varric in this outfit.
Oh my god, that would be amazing.
I do not think Mike and Brian would expect that.
Yeah, right?
But you would have to like alter it so that it would be a platypus bear. You need to get.
Oh
it.
Yeah, no, I'd do some work on it, yeah. But you know.
Yes, because currently this is just a bear.
Yeah, currently this is just a bear.
Just a bear?
Just a bear.
Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. This has been fun. Next week, somebody will be back here with the finale of Korra. Oh my goodness, crazy pants. Yeah. My name is Michal.
I'm Mitch.
I'm Brittany.
And I'm Karen.
Flameo, hot people.
Flameo, hot people indeed.